We're good?
Yeah. All right, well, let's get started. My name is Alistair Spears. I'm a senior operations PM in the Microsoft Office division. So I'm based out of Seattle, Washington, in the United States. I'm originally from Australia, so I'm a lot more used to this Madrid weather than some of my colleagues. It's great to be back in the warmth of 30-degree heat. In Seattle, we get 30-degree days maybe once or twice a year, usually for only 2 or 3 hours. So it's good to be warm again. I usually put this slide at the end, but I know some people want to rush out to the next session as well. So I just thought, as this is the first session, I'd really highlight these sessions as the ones that you really should go to today. Choosing the right cloud service. We'll talk a lot more about the Office 365 plans that are available to you, as well as different options at which ones to choose. As I mentioned earlier, Office 365 deployment we'll cover at the end of the day. And then later in the week, Office 365 security and Office 365 service communications. If you want to see just Office and Office 365 content, you can stay in this room for the entire week. The Exchange team have all of the Exchange sessions in N1, just across the hall, and then SharePoint is next door. So these three rooms, if you want to stay in the productivity world, you can see all of your sessions in the same little area here. Let's talk about today. You know, today in this session, what we're really here to talk about is Office 365, and really what happens inside of Office 365. I know many of you are probably using Office 365 or have tried Office 365. Who's using Office 365 today for their production mailbox, SharePoint sites, Link, anyone? Okay, so about half the room is using Office 365. Who has not transitioned to the new Office 365 yet, still on the Wave 14? A couple of hands still on the Wave 14. Okay, so there'll be a few things that are new here as well. And then who's looking to move to Office 365 but hasn't yet? A couple. Okay, great. Well, hopefully this is insightful for you. I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about the features and functions of Office 365. I hope by now we all know email, we all know Exchange, we know what SharePoint does, and we know what Office does. So I'd like to talk more about really the infrastructure behind it and what we do to take a product like Exchange and make it into an enterprise-grade cloud service. How we can take SharePoint or Link and really run this at scale. And not only from the technology point of view, but also from the operations process point of view as well. Now, my role at Microsoft is really around focusing on deployment. So my team's goal is to help IT pros migrate to Office 365. You know, we do believe that that is inevitable. We think that pretty much all organizations eventually will be running productivity workloads in Office 365. Where we're open to a lot of debate is whether that change will happen in the next 5 years or the next 50 years. And the reality is, depending on you, depending on your customer, depending on your users, you have a different timeline at how you move to the cloud. But you know, it's no longer something that we think is an option. It's really something that we think is pretty much inevitable. But that time frame is still fairly long for some organizations, longer than others. The cloud needs to get better in certain aspects for certain regulated industries. The cloud needs, network infrastructure needs to get better to catch up and those sorts of things. So there's a lot of reasons why people will move to the cloud at different phases. But we do think it's inevitable, and that's what we're really going to talk about here today, of how Office 365 works, how it delivers an enterprise-grade service, and how we envision the role of IT changing as we adopt more of these cloud services as well. So I don't want to talk too much about what's in Office 365, but just so everyone has the same understanding, I'd like to go through this kind of diagram. This is how I think of Office 365. And what we probably all know is that Office 365 is a collection of productivity services. It includes Exchange Online, SharePoint Online, Link Online, and now Yammer as well, our enterprise social network. What a lot of people didn't know, though, is that Office 365 also includes the client applications. Applications like Office 365 Pro Plus, which is the client version of Office that you get through Office 365, as well as Project, Vizio, and even mobile access. You would have seen last week we announced the iPhone apps for the Office apps on iPhone. And those apps are actually all delivered through Office 365 as well. So we think of Office 365 not just as the server workloads that you once ran in servers, but it's also a delivery mechanism to get the client software that still runs on the PC, but is delivered and managed through Office 365. That's what the users see. Then under the hood, we also think of Office 365 as a set of consolidated user experiences. You know, by and large, Exchange running in the cloud and Exchange running on premises look and feel very similar. What makes Office 365 different is some of these underlying layers, these consolidated user experiences. We know, for instance, that Office 365 customers have Exchange and SharePoint and Link all at their fingertips. So we can do a lot more interesting things tying that all together with consistent sign-up experiences, with consistent admin portals, consistent reporting and landing pages, and those sorts of things as well. And then if we get really down to the back end, there's a whole lot of shared platform services as well. You know, the commerce and billing systems that these systems play into so that you get the bill at the end of the month. The identity platform that helps you manage users across not only these applications and these workloads, but also any other workload inside of Microsoft or perhaps any other workload that you want to federate with through Windows Azure Active Directory services. It's also our service management platform, how we do break fix, service interruptions, and just planned maintenance as well. And of course, it's the network and the infrastructure that has to run all of this different stuff as well behind the scenes. So let's start then. Let's talk about the cloud just for a moment before we talk about the infrastructure. And this is how I think oftentimes when we're talking to our managers or our business users, they think of the cloud as this fluffy, happy place in the sky. You know, I've seen countless salespeople look up to the ceiling when they talk about the cloud as if it's running in satellites or something. The reality is, cloud is big infrastructure running in big data centers. It's not some fluffy cloud somewhere else. And in 2013, we're pretty much all using cloud services somewhere in our daily lives, whether that's for email, whether that's for online gaming, whether that's for social networking, or whether that's how we store our files, get security patches, or mail scanning, whether that's just how we buy and consume music or subscribe to music, or whether that's even how we look at video services and those sorts of things. But you know, these cloud services, the ones I've outlined here, primarily consumer, and we all probably use these on a day-to-day basis. We've benefited a lot from them, but also I think something else that is interesting around cloud computing, especially in the consumer world, is that cloud computing services often benefit from us as well. There's an economy of scale, there's a network effect that happens that makes some of these cloud services better over time, the more people use them as well. And I think something to be wary of when we're thinking about cloud is that oftentimes I feel like people are equating a consumer cloud experience with an enterprise cloud experience. And they are very different sorts of experiences, particularly when you look into the free models of cloud computing services. When you look at a free cloud service, often it's all about how many users do I get? How much more relevant information do I build up about you as a user? How do I profile you and what you like and who you're attached to and where you spend your money and those sorts of things? And the reason for those questions is that they're funded by advertising, more or less. And those advertising funding services really rely on you, not as a customer, but really as a product. You're the inventory that is being sold to the customer. And the customer in this case is perhaps an advertising company or it's someone trying to advertise a certain product. Now, there's argues to say that, well, if advertising's good enough, it's not really advertising. It's actually just contextual information. Well, the difference between advertising and contextual information, though, is that someone's paid to advertise to you, and so you are really the product there, not the customer. So when we look at Office 365, we're talking about an enterprise cloud service. You know, our business model in Office 365 is really straightforward. You pay us money, we make you work better. Like that's the relationship. If we don't make you work better, you don't pay us money, and off we go. So, you know, for us, the user and organizational productivity is king. It's the key thing that we absolutely have to deliver in Office 365. It's what we wake up and do every morning, is how we get more and more productivity through there. You know, our funding models, it's a monthly subscription. It's also available through volume licensing. It also includes support. Now, I said 25/7. Support around the clock with financially backed SLAs there. And really, you know, you are the customer. As the IT pro, you're the person that can pick up the phone and talk to Microsoft at any time to really talk through anything that's going on with these services as well. So when we think about, you know, productivity and user productivity and breaking it down a little bit more, these are the sorts of things that get us up in the morning and make us go to work. You know, these two trends at the top are those things that we've spent a lot of our time focused on in the Office division. The first is how we build these comprehensive tools for you to do your best work. And this is something that has really changed over the years. The idea behind Office has always been tools to do your best work. But what that has meant and what that looks like has really changed over time as well. We've moved from a traditional PC landscape for now you're carrying a PC, a mobile phone, a tablet, and you want to have great experiences across all those devices. But not siloed experiences. You need a system that connects all together so that you can work across all of those different devices as well in a way that suits you. I have a laptop here, I have a phone, I have my tablet. I'm using all of these things just to do my work in my day. And some of these I'm provisioning myself, I'm managing myself. The Microsoft IT department is not even involved in servicing the devices themselves. Instead, they're managing it from an enterprise cloud service instead, allowing me to have access to the certain devices and those sorts of things, allowing me to have access to the right information on the right devices depending on the security policy or the classification of that particular data. Another interesting way I like to look at it is that, you know, on the consumer side and on the tool side and the end user computing, the devices that we use every day, there's just an explosion of those sorts of devices and different form factors, different device sizes, big screens, little screens, touch screens, you know, 3D screens and Kinect wavy hand things and all that sort of stuff. You know, and it will keep going. When we look at that sort of hardware, there is not a price floor of that hardware. When we think about computers, when we think about silicon, silicon is hot sand. You know, it's very cheap to make. You know, so once you can print chips, and once you can start printing chips at a very cost-effective rate, the price will just continue to drop on that sort of hardware. On the other side, though, on the enterprise-grade cloud services, the complexity is around how you can manage so much of that hardware. It starts becoming really a logical complexity problem rather than a physical capacity problem when we start to look at cloud services even more. So you can think of this as an explosion on one hand and a consolidation on the other. These two trends that are almost completely opposite are happening at the same time, and as IT pros, we're kind of in the thick of it to try and manage that for our own organizations. So let's talk about the cloud service now. And really, when I think about cloud services or enterprise IT in general, the two things that I think about most are how we build them and how we manage them. And so we'll go through that with an Office 365 flavor here as well. So let's start with scalable. I got a question earlier, how many users do we have in Office 365? And it's really in the hundreds of millions is how we measure how many users we have operating in Office 365 at any given time. And to do that, we have data centers spread out all around the world that can actually provision this sort of infrastructure. Clicker. So in terms of doing this, you know, we have these massive data centers spread out around the world. We don't give out the exact numbers of how many we have. We say between 10 and 100 of these data centers. And when we say data center at Microsoft, we mean something that is typically in the 60 to 100,000 server range. Anything smaller than that, we typically just think of a facility or a server farm or under someone's desk or something like that. But when we say data center at Microsoft, we're talking about a very, very big, sophisticated engine as well. But we don't just rely on these data centers. These data centers then connect to essentially a content delivery network. These, you can think of these as mini data centers or mini installations and infrastructure spread out around the world to really improve the speed, the throughput that you get back into those anchor data centers spread out around the world as well. And then, of course, there's a huge network that's connecting all these sorts of assets together to provide very fast speeds between all of these networks as well. There was a question at the back before. Sure. So there's a question about redundancy. What if one of these data centers goes down? You know, what happens? Great question. We'll cover that a little bit when we talk about how the resiliency works for all of the different applications. We have a number of layers of resilience in there, not only from a physical data center, essentially a complete copy of that same data center in a different place, but also how we handle the logical failover when certain parts of the data center may fail or certain services may fail within the data center as well. You know, we really think that, you know, trying to rely on a data center to be up 100% of the time is not the right way to go about it. Instead, what we focus on is making sure that the service experience is up 100% of the time, and then we just make sure that we have enough infrastructure to run that service experience as well. Another question? What about backup? Yeah, absolutely. We'll talk about that a little bit later when we get on the architecture of the specific service as well. Yeah. We do backups. So when we look into the region itself, we're here in Europe, so you know our two primary data centers that we use for Office 365 are in Amsterdam and Dublin. You know, this services all of Europe through these two data centers as well. And essentially, those data centers then connecting out to these edge nodes, and those edge nodes are really on the back of our fiber optic network, so they're connected at very fast speeds back into our data centers. And then from there, those edge nodes essentially peer out, and they set up peering relationships with local telecommunications providers, your telecoms provider, your cable company, or something like that. And it's that peering relationship that essentially means that traffic going to Office 365, or actually any Microsoft property, will prefer to go through these edge nodes into that back-end network. So that's the fastest connection back to Office 365. And then, of course, you have that last mile. And when you look at the last mile, your mileage will vary depending on what your connection is back to your metro provider and then that metro provider's connection back to Office 365. But one of the interesting things that we can do at Microsoft, and especially in Office, is that we don't just rely on a server solution to run this. We have tools like Outlook, tools like Office, Word, Excel. And having tools like that on the client end, running on the PC, means that we can be a little bit smarter at how we use that traffic or shape that traffic as it goes across the network as well. For instance, if you open a Word document from SharePoint and you save that Word document, what Word is actually doing is it's looking at that document, inspecting what changed in that document, and only sending those changes across the wire. So you're not sending the full document every time you hit save. It's just only sending those, you know, two sentences that you added to the document or something like that. In the case of Link, Link will set up a peer-to-peer video calling solution between those users. Essentially, the role of the Link servers in some of these environments when you're doing a point-to-point voice call or a video call is actually just to establish that connection, and then it's talking directly. So you get to bypass a lot of this stuff using some of that smarts that's happening on the client side as well as what's happening on the server side as well. So how does that look like when we start to look into something like Exchange? Well, essentially what that means is that in Exchange, we have thousands of these Exchange servers running, and essentially we manage them in what we call a stamp, which is kind of the smallest atomic unit that we can get in Exchange. You know, there are different ways to provide scale, right? You can scale up or you can scale out. And we prefer to scale out in these sorts of environments. We add more and more servers, we partition those servers, we divide them up into regions. And so what happens is that at any given time, if you're on Exchange Online, your mailbox exists on four different physical discrete assets in two different locations. So in terms of backup, That is your backup scenario there. You just move to a different server that's running live with all of your mail still intact across the network as well. If an entire data center goes down, your mailbox still exists at the other data center, and you can get back up and running almost instantaneously as well. Yeah, question? When a user deletes data, can they get it back? Yes, absolutely. And so there are a number of tools that we have in place to prevent users deleting their own data, for IT administrators to restore data, to put immutable holds on content across this approach as well. But this sort of infrastructure is really protecting you from physical, you know, or logical failure rather than malicious or accidental errors as well. But there are other tools in Exchange Online that will prevent that as well.
A question? The replication is awesome, but what if you guys have some kind of bug that actually spreads corrupt data to all core components? Do you have
Absolutely. And so we'll take backups across all this environment as well to do those sorts of things. Yeah. Question at the front.
Is this all sitting on the Azure infrastructure, or is it a different environment for the
case? Great question. Is this sitting on the Azure infrastructure? You know, the short answer is no. The longer answer is, well, it depends what you define as Azure. So what we run here is we run all of this infrastructure on top of the what we call the global foundational services at Microsoft. So this is our key data center infrastructure that all of Microsoft services are run out of, whether it's Azure, whether it's Bing, whether it's Xbox, whether it's just the Office Clipart library. They all run out of these centralized assets. So the hardware and network is exactly the same as what you get out of Azure. And then depending on the service, you see different things coming from Azure than perhaps in other areas. And so some of our services, in the case of Exchange, it is all dedicated hardware. In the case of Office 365 Pro Plus or the Office web apps, they're actually served entirely out of Azure to run those sorts of environments as well. You know, when we think about designing these solutions, the first thing we have to think about is why wouldn't we build it in Azure? You know, we don't particularly want to run Windows servers. If Azure can do that for us, fantastic. We can focus on running Exchange and those sorts of things as well. So I'm going to move through here. There'll be some other time for questions as I move through the sections. I'm sorry, guys, but we have a lot to cover here. Give you a similar example of SharePoint. And who's a SharePoint expert in the room? There's always one or two. Yeah, there they are. Yeah. So, you know, SharePoint is a pretty straightforward infrastructure, really. You have your Active Directory, you bolt on some SQL, you bolt on some SharePoint servers, web front ends, and those sorts of things. You divide it up into different service applications. And then there's a bunch of federated services that you may also choose to run to help that SharePoint infrastructure interact with other services that you may run as well. And so again, in this atomic unit, this we call a stamp. And it's those stamps that we then replicate across the data center. And when we add capacity to Office 365, we don't do it on a per server or per user basis. We essentially roll out these stamps at a time. In the case of SharePoint, these stamps represent between 100 and 200,000 user capacity, depending on how active those users are. And so when we need more capacity, we just roll out stamps in this sort of environment. In the case of SharePoint, the entire SharePoint infrastructure is virtualized, running on Hyper-V in this particular infrastructure as well. So you have multiple stamps running inside the data center. Then inside the data center as well, you have some management environments that actually make up the management of those stamps as well. You need things like SCOM, you need things like Active Directory synchronization, you need DNS, backup services, and all those sorts of things that you'd have to do yourself if you were running your own SharePoint environment. We group all of these things together in a self-contained unit called a network. And then we run multiple networks inside the data center. We whack some load balancers on front of it. And we also have an entire replicated infrastructure in a separate data center as well. So we run that in the same stamps, those same networks, in a completely separate data center as we go through this here as well. So if something happens to the entire data center, there's another complete backup over it. As well as if something happens to the stamp within the data center, there are stamp failovers as well inside of that environment, as we talk about. So that's essentially the model for scaling out in SharePoint Online. We also have a bunch of other services that run on top of this that essentially manage this entire process as well. You know, when we think about this, we want to make sure that our incident management systems, content delivery networks running on the Azure platform, what we call the grid manager. The grid manager is the thing that allocates resources across all these environments. These are other things that we had to custom build for Office 365 to solve some of the scale problems that we had at this sort of level. And that's kind of a quick way of how we scale it out. It allows us to operate, you know, tenants with up to 25 terabytes of information in them, 25 gigs of mailboxes per month at a really cheap price. You know, we can do unlimited mail archiving through this infrastructure as well. And we can deal with hundreds of millions of mailboxes and billions of messages a day passing through these networks as well. So it is really big infrastructure when we look at this as well. But scalability is only one part of the problem, right? There's reliability, and we have a few questions about reliability, how we handle reliability in Office 365. You know, so one of the things that we do, and we have a whole other session that will go into more detail about this and our service communication session, but one of the things that we really rely on is service continuity by design. You know, there's a huge change for us in the Office team from once building a product that we'd give to you and say, good luck with that, call us if you have any problems, to actually running a service ourselves. You know, and it's the engineering team running the service. It's not like a separate other team and those sorts of things. So if something goes wrong in Office 365, it's the engineer responsible for that feature that gets woken up at 2 a.m., that gets taken off doing the new cool stuff and told to fix the old stuff. And you can imagine that, you know, there were a lot of complaints when we first started doing this sort of thing. But a strange thing happened. After about 6 months, the code started to get a lot better. People stopped getting woken up at all hours in the morning. We started to think about graceful failure. We started to add features like managed availability that it's right across the hall they're talking about now. So those sorts of things were because of running this infrastructure at such a scale. And some of those learnings, actually, even if you don't decide to go to Office 365 tomorrow, you decide to stick with SharePoint Server or Exchange Server, you know, the things that we learned building Office 365 have gone back into those products that you see some of those capabilities today. So in Office 365 specifically, you know, the redundancy, whether it's physical redundancy, data redundancy, functional redundancy, and the logical topologies we design. And we look at the resiliency. It's how we do load balancing across all this infrastructure to keep it all working as smoothly as possible. You know, moving mailboxes around. It's almost like a Schrodinger's cat problem, right? Where you have four active mailboxes at any time, and then maybe you have 1,000 users. How many different mailboxes, how many different mail servers are you operating on? It's probably hard to tell. And if you knew today which ones they were, it could be different in 2 minutes' time as we just constantly reallocate load across all those different services to ensure that, you know, while the particular hardware you're using may change, the service experience is continual as you go through that same experience as well. We also make sure we distribute the workloads as well. You know, this concept of really loose coupling of the different services. We absolutely do not want a problem in SharePoint to be able to crash your Exchange server, or a problem in Link to replicate through the environments, or one stamp having problems to affect other users on different stamps or different data centers or anything like that. So that sort of that resiliency is built into the way that we isolate those components and the way that we design the service itself. Human backups. You know, this is something that is, I think, is actually pretty interesting. You know, you can have a fully automated system, but you get weird behaviors when you have a fully automated system. You know, sometimes you just need someone looking at something to, you know, using the old Mark I eyeball to actually work out some of these problems. And so even though we have automated recovery alerts, we have a lot of things that are designed to gracefully recover the systems until the engineer wakes up in the morning. If there are urgent problems, there are escalation paths to get a person looking at that issue as soon as possible with the most information, the most experience to solve that particular issue. In doing that, though, we want to make sure that we have very predictable and very inspectable logging across all this environment. We generate around 12 terabytes a day of log files alone. So all those log files actually, you know, get compiled at the end of the day and get analyzed and work out, you know, what has happened. Are there things that are critical that are happening there? And sometimes, you know, an error being thrown isn't particularly a problem, but if you start to see a trend that errors are thrown on Fridays or something like that, it helps us analyze information, helps us prevent certain issues from occurring in the past, as well as being a great way for us to audit and secure the environment as well. And the other approach is just to avoid complexity. You know, there is a number of things that you can do to add complexity to your environment really, really fast. Can you imagine, you know, if you have an SLA of 3.9 support, you know, does that mean you can assemble the infrastructure out of a series of components that have a 99.9% success rate? It doesn't. If you have more components, you need more nines. You know, you need highly reliable components to build on other things. Or you need to start to work around those problems. You know, if you have, you know, a router that has one set of firmware and you have a support contract that only goes between 9 and 5, and if you operate something like Office 365, where we allow ourselves only 43 minutes of downtime a month, then that's a huge issue when we have to rely on support escalations that can take hours, days, weeks sometimes. I'm sure some of you experienced, you know, escalations to different vendors, maybe even Microsoft, that take longer than 43 minutes to resolve. And so these sorts of things are things we need to avoid as we design this sort of service as well. So to do that, you know, we talked about this earlier, but it's really around loosely coupling those workloads. Exchange Online operates differently from SharePoint Online, operates differently from Link Online. The Exchange team run Exchange Online as you'd expect. The SharePoint team run SharePoint Online. The Exchange team aren't allowed to make changes to SharePoint Online. You know, there's very strict controls in how we do these things. And essentially, you can think of it like loose contracts that go between these applications, where there are things that we depend on other services to run. We have a contract in place of how that operates. An example of that was Windows Azure Active Directory. Windows Azure Active Directory is the common identity platform for all of Office 365. But every service needs to consume that, and every service needs to have its own identity backup in case something goes wrong with the connection with Windows Azure AD, so it can keep operating even if you have a graceful failure. Perhaps you can't add users. There's a delay of adding users for 2 hours or something like that. But the service keeps going, the users can keep using the service, and those sorts of things. So that's one of the ideas behind loose coupling of all these different services as well. Also a topic of system monitoring, and you know, in this example we'll talk about Exchange. You know, Exchange, if anyone's used the Exchange management pack for SCOM, you'll know that Exchange will generate around 1,700 different alerts. How many of those are important? How many of those impact their user? Don't know. You know, it's very hard to tell on those sorts of things. And what we found, it's very easy for a developer to add an alert. You know, if you want something measured, you know, if you're debugging code, you put debug breaks everywhere, and then you go through, if you know your code, you know what those alert messages mean, you know where those breaks are occurring and those sorts of things. When we inflict that on everyone else, that's kind of painful. Right, and so as we looked at it, we realized that there were only about 200 alerts that really meant customers were impacted. There are 200 things that we really needed to trace. All those other alerts were important, but they could wait until morning. Right? So if one of those 200 things happened, we needed to monitor that. We needed to urgently escalate when those sorts of things happened as well. And so what we do, you know, in terms of just monitoring those alerts that get generated, we also look at outside-in monitoring. And so what this is around the world, we have a number of points that are just pinging back to these services to make sure they can connect to every mailbox, to every mailbox server, sorry, not every mailbox, to every CAS server to make sure that the connections are still working. And they can report back, you know, so we can identify that if problems happen, we can actually force that particular server, that particular stamp, that particular infrastructure to fail over. You know, fail it over, the user doesn't notice, we wait until morning, and then we'll work out why it failed over later. You know, the priority is to get the servers back up and running rather than to particularly debug and diagnose every particular solution before we get the solution back up and running. You'd rather have mail flowing than having a really good answer on day one. And that's why we give ourselves a little bit of time to do that root cause analysis when we can return the service to operation. Again, another session there, Exchange High Availability and Site Resilience. It's later today in N1, so if you really want to geek out on the Exchange stuff, you can look at that session. Or you can take our word for it and let us do it. In terms of SharePoint, you know, SharePoint has a slightly different architecture to Exchange, perhaps understatement of the year, but it still has the same concepts around how it fails. So if we imagine a scenario now of saving a document into SharePoint, how does that work from the infrastructure point of view? Well, firstly, you save that document, it hits a disk, and at that point, you essentially have no redundancy to that particular document. So you're having a SharePoint server running, no backups on it. You don't have any redundancy in terms of saving as well. And you can put RAID 10 on it, and then you've got two copies of that particular document in case anything goes wrong. So your failure scope there is at the disk level. You can lose an entire disk and still not lose your data as well. Then we can look at synchronous mirroring. We can mirror that content across to a complete separate rack or a complete separate stamp. And in that particular case, then, we'll also asynchronously ship those logs. And if you understand SharePoint, you know it's SQL Server behind the scenes. And SQL Server supports asynchronous log shipping. So we can move that out to that separate data center. So at this stage now, you have six different copies of that particular document spread across two different data centers. So at this stage, your failure scope is really losing an entire data center at a time as well. Then we need to go beyond that. We take scheduled backups in case there's any corruption introduced into that system. Then we asynchronously move that across to the other data center as well, just in case we lose that entire data center, and then we lose something else in the other infrastructure as well. So at this point, we've got over 10 different copies of that one document that you've saved into a SharePoint server. So I'll let you do the maths. If you can have a 25 terabyte tenant and you need to store 10 copies of it, over a few hundred million users. That's a whole lot of storage there. So these scheduled backups really allow us to do point-in-time restores. And that's really the point of those point-in-time restores is when there's a bug in the software or something like that. It's introduced corruption in that data. We've shipped that corrupt data across all the different disks. We need to go back to a point-in-time restore. For a user, for a tenant itself, if you need to actually restore a particular piece of data, you don't use this point-in-time infrastructure. You actually use the recycle bin. We have a recycle bin inside of SharePoint Online that you can restore from. If you delete from the SharePoint Online recycle bin, there's an administrator recycle bin that you can restore from. If you delete from the administrator recycle bin, there's a site collection administrator recycle bin that you can restore from as well. And if something goes wrong in the copy, we also keep a client-side cache of that information so that if the network drops out or something like that, the user can still save it the next time it connects as well. That's some of that benefit of using Office to save into SharePoint, is that Office knows how to talk to SharePoint, and it knows when SharePoint's doing something it's not supposed to do, and it'll try again later to save that document as well. So move on to efficiency now and talk about some of the efficiency improvements that we've made in the data centers as well. So we talked about scalability, we talked about reliability, and this is kind of the final pillar in how we build our data centers. You know, one of the interesting things about data centers, that's a picture of Dan, by the way. One of the interesting things about our data centers, you know, that I found as I started to work closer and closer with Office 365, is the guys building the data centers are not IT guys. They're not IT guys. They look at IT like that's the user of whatever they build. Mostly they're electrical and mechanical engineers. That's the guys that really work on these data centers because essentially they're data factories. Right? They build these massive things that need to run, and they have a customer, and that particular customer is called the IT load. That customer needs two things. It needs a lot of electricity, and it spits out a lot of heat. So that's really the problem. It's a problem of electrical capacity and thermodynamics, which is what our data center engineers are trying to solve for. So if you look at the chain of how it gets there, you know, you have UPS systems, transformers, generators that transform it back to get from the power supply. Then, you know, to take out that heat, typically you'll have a computer room air conditioning unit or something like that that needs a chiller and a condenser and cooling towers and then, of course, a water supply. So all of these things are, again, pieces that can fail. And these are pieces that you need to think about when you're running your own data center, I'll use the term loosely, server room, in your environment. You need to think about all these different components as well. And these components, again, can affect that service level that you can offer your customers or users. So typically, a data center, and this is a stat called PUE, or power usage effectiveness. This is the industry standard way of benchmarking data centers. And typically what we find is that an enterprise data center operates at around a PUE of 2. What that means, for every 2 watts in that data center, only 1 watt is going to electricity, is going to the IT load itself. The rest gets wasted in the cooling systems, in the electrical systems, the UPS systems that just leak power across the place as well. And what we see is that most cloud data centers, because of this consolidation, because of this massive amount of scale, you can solve these problems a lot more efficiently. You're not trying to reverse engineer like an office into a server room, you know, putting in the raised flooring. You know, I've heard all sorts of customer stories about not being able to put any more racks in the server room because the weight will collapse the roof and it's the cafeteria downstairs, you know, or that the basement will flood so they can't get air conditioning there. Or a particular bad story was that they found that the humidity just dropped inside of the data center, inside of the server room so much that it would cause some of the hardware to short out. And so their solution was to actually have a tap slowly dripping in the data center to control the humidity. It was a total MacGyver solution, but it worked for them. And so when you're doing this at cloud scale, you can solve it a little bit more efficiently, a little bit better for how we do these sorts of things. And along the way, we've tried different approaches to do this, and we operate, you know, data centers for quite some time now in a very different way of getting that kind of power usage effectiveness, getting that cost down in these sorts of environments as well. We move past that generation one, essentially a co-located data center, sticking your servers and your racks in a room, to our generation two data centers. And essentially the difference with generation two data centers is we started to install them racks at a time. No longer were you putting in particular 1U, getting the scissor lift out to put in the rack. You're actually trucking in and wheeling in the entire rack, mounting that in, plugging it all up, and getting it up and running as well. When you start designing around racks instead of around servers in racks, then there's a whole different approach you can take to how you do hot aisles, cold aisles, how you control the airflow through the data center itself to maximize the efficiency you can get out of that. And then in about 2008, we moved to essentially a containment model. The idea was, rather than shipping racks, why don't we ship multiple racks, all pre-configured? You'd buy them from our hardware vendors, already installed in an ISO shipping container. So they just come off the back of the truck and get lowered into place. And then away they go with 3,000 or 4,000 servers already configured inside of it. And that was great in terms of scalability. We could really turn it on a lot faster. But the thermo properties of an ISO shipping container aren't really conducive to hardware. And so we got on to kind of our fourth model here. And this is really the modular style data center. These are the latest things that we've started to deploy. These things we call IT packs, or information technology pre-assembled components. And essentially in this model, we're essentially trying to reduce as much assets and moving parts as possible as we set this up. So you can see here in the diagram, and I have some better pictures here. But essentially it's made up of four components. It's the IT load. It has an evaporated cooling unit, an air handling unit, and then a mixing unit. So essentially what happens here is that this evaporative cooling unit is essentially mesh, kind of a Hessian mesh in front of it, and it'll slowly drip water down to keep a consistent level of humidity through. And just air will naturally blow through this evaporated cooling unit. The IT load here will suck that air through. And this air handling unit just makes sure that there's kind of a pressure difference between the outside pressure and the pressure on the inside of the data center. So that naturally just pulls this air through those evaporative cooling units without having to be powered with fans or anything like that. Cooling the servers, and the air handling unit sucks that air out and pushes some of it back to the mixing. So that's essentially how we control that. What the temperature is going through that is how much of that hot air we recycle back through the data center itself. The beauty of this model, you know, the fantastic thing about this model is that you don't even have to worry about air conditioning anymore. This server lives outside. This data center lives outside. We build a roof over it. This is our Quincy data center, which is in eastern Washington. It has a climate fairly similar to Madrid in many ways. A little bit more water. But these things can live outside. We build a roof over the top to prevent the worst of the weather getting to it. But essentially, just operates like that. It takes about 4 hours to install. And it only has three connections coming out of it: the ping, the pipe, and the power. And essentially, it's electricity, garden variety water hose, and network connection, and away it goes. It's operating as a data center, all remotely monitored, all operating from this unit as well. These are extremely energy efficient in how we do these things, and this is installing about 2,500 servers at a time in these building blocks as we design out these sorts of things as well. It's kind of a picture of how it installs. You can see these guys are data center engineers. It's starting to look more and more like truck drivers in this sort of environment. And this is essentially as it, just before we kind of push them all together. But that's, you can see all the different units there running as well. Similarly, in Dublin, this is another one of our massive data centers. It's one of the biggest ones in Europe as well. It's won all sorts of awards for its energy efficiency. It doesn't use any air-conditioned air either. It's in Dublin. Why would it? And so it just uses outside air. It's powered by renewable energy, in this case wind power, and uses about 29.4 megawatts of power to run all those servers inside it as well. So it's an extremely efficient data center that we have operating here, but it's targeted to the environment it runs in, and that's kind of some of the art around data centers that, you know, depending on where it is, there's about 30 to 50 different variables that can affect how you particularly design those data centers. You know, what's the price of electricity? Do you have access to fresh water? Is it close to a network grid? What's the outside air temperature? What's the seismic capacity look like in that particular area? And those sorts of things as well. Yeah, question.
Can you tell us something about the security around this data
center? Sure. That's great. And we do have a session on Office 365 security. We go into this in more detail. But it is a shed and a roof and a fence and a security guard and 24/7 access monitoring, video cameras, you know, biometric scanners and all those sorts of things as well. So it's, yeah, perhaps I was being a little too facetious when I said it's just sitting outside in a shed. a very highly secure shed operating at ISO 27001. SSAE, EU model clauses, EU safe harbor legislation as well. And this is an example inside the Dublin data center. In this case, this is more the generation 2 style. But you can see here these racks all set up. And they're actually set up to be kind of sealed from air. So you can see here the door, they're sealing off there. Two racks facing each other, air getting sucked in through the outside, through the cold aisles, and then essentially pulled out the top through the ceiling there as the hot air rises, as the pressure difference pulls that hot air out the top of the server room in this case. Okay, so we talked about building it. Let's talk about managing it as well. Firstly, control. If you're doing anything in Office 365, in SharePoint server, in Exchange server, anything like that, you need to think about role-based access control. You know, if you have more than one user, you want role-based access control because there's someone that will manage and someone won't. And so role-based access control really requires, it kind of tells the environment who can have access to what functionality, what they're allowed to do, and where are they allowed to do it. So in this case, you may want to start to divide up who can manage your mailboxes. You may want to have a help desk person that can view them. You may want to have a help desk person that can only view them in a certain country or for a certain department or something like that. Or you may have a legal compliance officer that can only look at the compliance capabilities of that platform. They can do it across the world or perhaps a specific team and those sorts of things. This functionality has been in a lot of the products for a long time now. But the same concept applies in Office 365 as well. You know, all of our administrators get their access through role-based access control. You know, one of the things that I guess should be fairly obvious is that Office 365's network is not the same as the Microsoft network. It's very different when you look at in an on-premises server where you join your Exchange server to the domain, you join your SharePoint server to the domain, and those sorts of things as well. We have a completely segregated network between our corporate network and the 365 data center network. And so the way that admins get access to that is essentially taking role-based access control one step further. And in this case, essentially what happens is that an Office 365 admin requests access for that environment. And essentially this is logged as a service request. You can see these service requests when you go into your Office 365 admin portal and look at the service requests you've raised, or look at the audit logs to see which administrators have been operating on your service and for what reason they're operating that service as well. And we have a tool called Lockbox. And essentially what Lockbox does, it takes that role-based access control one step further, and it allocates essentially just-in-time permissions on that particular environment for a time-specific window as well. So what this does, gives least privilege access to a particular functionality that's required. It sets up a time, 20 minutes, 15 minutes, 5 minutes. It has to be approved by the manager. And even to get access to this system, there's a whole series of security checks that go on behind the scenes as well. And again, everything in this process is audited as they get temporary privilege escalation onto that service to do some sort of task and those sorts of things as well. So this is essentially how we take role-based access control one step further and audit it at every step in the way as well. And these audits you can even see through the Office 365 admin portal. Give you an example of how we look at some of the data that we collect from all that logging information. This is an example of some read-only data that we have access to here. And I'll just run this video of the tool, which kind of shows you how our administrators can get a view of the system as well. You know, a bunch of reports we generate here. And this is essentially, we're looking at some Exchange servers there. The green ones you can see are fully operating. The yellow ones are being in the process of decommissioned. And the red ones are offline. So you can see here we're looking through, you know, servers operating of a specific type in a specific region across specific data centers there. And we can zoom in on particular ones if we need to as well. Jump into one there. I won't even pretend I'm doing this demo. We can look at the roles, you know, see how they're operating as well. You know, fun fact, these Exchange servers generally only live for about 2 weeks. We run them. We load on mailboxes, we take off mailboxes, we re-image the box, and off we go again. You know, we churn it, it's often that much easier to image rather than try to patch them and keep all patches. You get sort of configuration creep when you have a lot of patching going on in a sort of a high-volume environment like this, that changes are introduced, and oftentimes it's just better to baseline it back to the standard image and then roll out those standard images across the environment as well. So what that means, at any given time, we could be running 5 or 6 different configurations of Exchange Server in the environment. You know, we don't want to image everything at once. What if there's a problem in the new version? We want to make sure we start small and then kind of roll it out from there. And so our operations model has really evolved over time to include, you know, from just the traditional model of having like a service, an operations team, and then escalate to the product team, and then hear back 3 weeks later that it may be fixed in the next roll-up update, to a service IT model where we have tiers of operations we can escalate and escalate. But even still, that tiered model of operations still took too long to resolve issues. It didn't allow us to resolve issues within 43 minutes a month, which is really where we need to get to. So the next approach we went was around direct support, calling the engineering team directly to escalate in that approach as well. That was great from a learning point of view, but it wasn't exactly a sustainable model, and we couldn't build out that operations specialty that we've started to build out now in our new model. And what this is about is engineering the operations system itself. So we rely on software now to try and prioritize these issues, recover what we can recover, and then we have a specific operations team that works closely with the product teams, with the support teams, to diagnose issues and bake that back into our software-aided processes as well, so the issues don't reoccur at the same time as well. So security, and no one doubts, you know, the issues of security. And the bigger the service, the more impactful security breaches can be. This is an example of the stock market back on April 23rd of this month. The Associated Press Twitter account got hacked. And that's the impact on the stock market, you know, that one change. You know, it's a pretty scary when you think about kind of the power of these sorts of things. And the bigger the target, the bigger the impact when something goes wrong like this. So we take security very, very seriously in Office 365. Essentially, we do this in a number of ways. First, you know, the built-in security that we have across the platforms around encrypting data, securing the network, isolating customer data, automating the operations, and then monitoring that infrastructure from a physical, logical, and even personnel basis as well across that environment as well. There are also responsibilities that you have as an IT pro using the service as well. You're not outsourcing responsibility for your own security. And essentially, the customer controls that you're responsible for implementing around user access, antivirus or anti-spam, antivirus on your client PCs, anti-spam, configuring the anti-spam rules that we have in place in Office 365 to make sure that you're deploying the right level of encryption that you need for your particular organization, and making sure that you're compliant with all the local rules, regulation, governments and statutes that are responsible for your organization. So between these two things, you know, that is what gives you a secure Office 365 experience. And then around that, we validate that whole experience works with independent verification, whether that's through ISO 27001, whether that's through HIPAA, FISMA, the EU model clauses, EU safe harbor, data processing agreements, business access agreements, and all sorts of other things that need to go in place for you to satisfy all your compliance needs. We'll talk about this a lot more in Office 365 security session later in the week. Really encourage you to go and see this session if that's of interest to you. Advanced encryption I mentioned as well, and this is something that comes up a lot. You know, we do BitLocker on all of our Exchange servers in Office 365. You know, is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's a good thing. It's another level of security on that particular infrastructure. But what threat are we trying to meet when we're actually encrypting a hard drive? We're trying to meet the threat of someone walking out of the door with a hard drive. Now, there's a lot of other protections to make sure that the hard drives never leave our data center. We actually have these industrial grinders that turn nice, fresh hard drives into fine silver powder. And so we destroy all of our hard drives. We just eat the cost of whatever warranty would be in that particular environment. But there are other security things that you need to worry about as well, and some of these are your responsibility as well. If you have data of different classifications, you're responsible for making sure that your users are interpreting that data, enforcing the right compliance levels, the right encryption across that environment as well. You know, it's a mail server, it's a SharePoint side of document space, so you can encrypt it with whatever you like and put it up into those environments. We also build in rights management services into Office 365 as well, so you can actually use RMS to encrypt all those documents or the email, or even put in transport rules to do that for you as it flows through this environment as well. So talking about compliancy now, you know, there are a lot of different compliancy standards that we all need to meet, and so one of the ways that we address this is by trying to look at the standards themselves and breaking them down into a number of different things, breaking them down into the control framework that we need to implement to make sure that that standard can be met as the first thing. Then breaking that down even further to say, what is the policy? What does that business rule look like for us to meet a standard? Whether it's you must log every administrator action on that service, is that the business rule? If that's the business rule, it may be a business rule that's shared amongst a number of different certifications. Or attestations or standards and those sorts of things. So how do we do that? Essentially what we do is we take those policies and we break everything down to business rules. We build control frameworks around all those rules. And then this essentially is the kind of book of Office 365, all the business rules that we follow. And that in itself is the thing that is certified against ISO 27001. That is the ISO standard for IT operations. And that is the thing that we certify that body on. And that's kind of our proof that all these things are executed. Once we have that, once we have the proof that we're operating on all these things, essentially all the other standards are about assembling all of those policies and those control frameworks into the right pattern, into the right standard that meets that particular case, whether it's HIPAA, whether it's FISMA, the EU model clauses, or those sorts of things as well. So that's essentially how we do it. We're not certifying Office 365 for multiple different things at any given time. We do it in ISO 27001, and then it's really just a matter of mapping all those controls into whatever that other framework needs to be. So if there are specific laws or specific regulations that you need to follow that Office 365 doesn't explicitly meet, the first thing that you should do is look at those control frameworks that are validated through ISO 27001 and work out what the business rules you need to meet are and whether they're already met. If they're not, they're absolutely things that we take on board and we can look at putting in our next audit. We're generally under audit about 11 months of the year. We have about 4 weeks to make any changes until the next audit starts and those sorts of things. So there are windows to make changes to that, and we constantly add new certifications following that method. That's just a list you can see in the slide deck afterwards as well. So in terms of providing the best applications, there's a whole lot of challenge in how you can do that inside of your own environment. You know, when you patch, you know, you often think you'll deploy Exchange 2010, it'll be good for 3 years, then you can think about deploying Exchange 2013 or something like that. But the reality is there's a lot of changes that happen between those two points as well. Even between the Office 365 we released a year and a half ago and the Office 365 version that's in market today, we made a lot of different changes to the service in a monthly cadence through that sort of scenario. So you need to stop thinking about these as products specifically, but really as services that constantly get better over time. And so it can be a challenge to watch when these features are changing. You know, some of these features are actually pretty big. You know, iPad support, PDF support for SharePoint Online, 64-bit DirSync tools, and so on and so on. But there's a lot of changes that happen inside of the release windows that you may be familiar with as well. Office 365 is kind of that continuing trend of whatever's the latest at that point in time. We don't wait to package it up and test it for every single customer topology that may be deployed. We can look at just the big, the one topology we have in Office 365. So how do we do that in terms of change management? Again, this is something we'll talk about more in the service communication session later in the week. But the majority of the changes we make are done through code. So essentially, rather than just go and try and change one thing, we automate that process, validate the script will run appropriately, and then image that out to all those machines as well. This helps stop that configuration drift when you're making changes on one server and then the next server and the next server and those sorts of things. You just kind of re-baseline what the image looks like and then start imaging servers into that new baseline as well. It also allows us for great versioning because we can recover. You know, if we say, all right, that baseline is no longer working, we found a bug net, we need to roll it back, we know exactly which servers need to be rolled back. We just move mailboxes onto live servers and take the other ones out of production. There are times where we do need to make non-code changes, you know, quick things to fix the environment, to get it back up and running. And those sorts of things also need to go through a very strict peer review process when we look at those particular service incidents as well. All these changes happen, for the plan changes, they happen well in advance. They're reviewed very heavily before they go into it, and they go through a very long series of processes before it goes in. Just to give you an example of when we deploy something into production, we go through a number of different stages before it makes production. It's not just dev, then test, then prod, as you may be used to in kind of a developer scenario. We start with like these ad hoc topologies that the engineers run in their dev environment. That goes into a pre-check-in process where all of the changes are merged in together and check to make sure that they all work. You know, there's a post-check-in environment to make sure that nothing has changed in there. You know, a daily official build gets generated and official testing starts in that environment. Then we start to roll it out to what you can consider beta environments, you know, a service dog food environment. And our dog food environment is essentially what we run Microsoft on. And so we're testing, you know, these builds before they get trickled out. And as they pass those steps, we put it into what we call SIP, or a slice in production. We're operating some tenants on this new service or some servers on this new service and just see what happens. And then we can roll back if we notice any particular impacts. And then finally, you know, and sometimes this can take months to replicate through all the servers because, again, there's no rush to push that stuff out earlier if we don't need to. Sometimes it can take up to 3 months to fully propagate through all the servers on that particular new image. And by that time, there's probably another image right behind it. So that's why we re-image these servers every 2 weeks as we move them between these environments. So as we look at the role of IT in all this, and to kind of start to summarize here, you know, this is your traditional ITIL framework. When you think about IT roles and responsibilities, this is the stuff that we've always been on the hook to do as IT pros. And I kind of like to break this down as the stuff we do to run the business, and then the stuff we want to do to kind of grow and transform the business, putting in new technology, putting in new capabilities, or meeting the business needs rather than just trying to keep the lights on, keep the servers running, and those sorts of things. And even though there's plenty more stuff to do in this growth side, even when we look at something like ITIL, the reality is that most of our budget goes into the run side, most of our time and effort. You know, who spends more than 80% of their time maintaining the old system? Anyone? 50%? No one? Who spends all their time just working on new stuff? So the stuff that the guys that are working on the run state, they can't get time away to go to conferences or anything like that, can they? But really what happens in IT budgets, you're spending, and this is a study done by Gartner, but we're spending about 63% of our budget on that run state stuff and only about 37% of our time on putting in new capabilities, new technologies, and making changes to the business there. And so this is always a challenge. It means that we're always trying to catch up. We're trying to catch up to what's happening. We're trying to look at the things that are breaking, and it requires us to have these really broad and shallow skills. We're supposed to know everything about everything, because who knows what will be causing that particular problem? We need to kind of know it all. Whereas a specialist can operate in that kind of grow and transform space. You just go from one customer to the next, you know, deploying the same old solution, or you know, e-discovery and compliance, or something like that. And so really what we're trying to do with Office 365, and if you think about the kind of business strategy here, is that moving to Office 365 is taking that run stuff and letting Microsoft do it. And essentially, that's all about reducing the spend that you have on just operations. You know, patching, maintenance, upgrades, all that stuff goes away. That's Microsoft's responsibility. You're paying a monthly cost to make sure that you're always on the latest and greatest experience rather than trying to do that yourself, trying to get budget approval for this massive expenditure every 3 years and those sorts of things as well. So it allows you to free up all that time to focus on evolving the business instead. And of course, it improves your total cost of ownership of these sorts of solutions as well over time as well. So, you know, these are the things that as IT evolves, these sorts of scenarios are the things that are going to be great jobs to be part of in the future as the cloud gets bigger and bigger. You know, these sorts of things go away. The things in gray kind of start to go away and lessen importance as you focus more and more on driving and transforming the business and understanding what the requirements are for those businesses. I mean, we're not doing the same sort of business we were doing 10 years ago. Technology's really changed a lot of those things that we can do. And we can get back to the role of IT as being the role of working with the business to make sure they understand the right technology that they can move to as well. So really, it's about focusing back on your users, and that's what we want to try and help you do, is to stop worrying about all that deployment stuff and patch management and maintenance, worrying if you've got enough capacity, like load-bearing structural capacity in your building to support another server, worrying about whether there's too much humidity in your data center and all that sort of stuff. You know, we have experts that can do that, and they can do it at scale that is much more appealing. Again, you know, to make that really clear, it's not just about pretty pictures and fancy new Jetson-style technology, but it's also about how we deliver those enterprise-grade services, how you can use something that is scalable, reliable, efficient, you know, that has all the control, all the security mechanisms, and all the compliance capabilities that you require. And then it frees up that time. You can kind of outsource that commodity. You know, as much as email is interesting and email is great, by and large, email is the same for every different organization. It has to be. That's how email can communicate with every different organization. It's a very standardized process. How you decide to archive it, how you decide to manage it, how you decide to discover information across it, and the policies you put into it obviously differ from organization to organization. But the structure of a mailbox server and a CAS server Very similar across all different organizations. So going to this kind of standardized model, reduce those costs, and you can rely on Microsoft to deliver those latest technologies. It's in our best interest to make sure you're using the latest and greatest stuff. So you have a nice positive feedback loop so that you're using the latest and greatest, so you keep paying us money. It's as simple as that. And then the build lead time is another huge saving there. If you need to try something in SharePoint and it takes you 4 weeks to order the hardware and another 4 weeks to get the infrastructure team to provision it, whereas in Office 365, you can provision all that infrastructure in about 2 minutes. You can get up and running instantaneously. You can test out the idea. And even if you don't decide to go with Office 365, at least you haven't lost any money on building that infrastructure just for a pilot. So, you know, when you think about getting there, and I alluded to this back at the very start of the presentation for those that were here early, but we have a deployment framework that we like to use, and we call it Fast Track. And really it's about how you move in a very simple and deliberate manner through the deployment phases that you go through first. So it's around piloting the experience. And you can really pilot Office 365 in a couple of hours. You can get up and running, you can customize the environment, and you can spin up users and have people using Office 365 in production in only a few hours. And so that's generally how we recommend that you start your experience. And then it's a straightforward approach to move gracefully into production as you go up from there. So you can take tools like DirSync that can then do a soft match on the users you've created to line them up with your Active Directory accounts. You can start to provision that full capability, start to migrate across the mail they have on on-premises systems into this new platform here. And then finally, you can come back and look at extending and enhancing some of those capabilities that you have or that you didn't have on-premises into that new environment. You can start to add rights management services or the compliance tools and e-discovery tools or archiving or single sign-on environments and those sorts of things as you move through this model as well. So with that, thank you very much for listening. I hope you found this very instructional. If you have any questions, please let me know. But if I don't want to keep you, if you have another session to go to, so thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Great. Question up the front? Yeah.
The National Security Agency in North America can force Microsoft to expose all the mails. Can they also force them to expose mails which are in Ireland or in Amsterdam?
I was waiting for that question. I was surprised it took this long to come up. Yeah, okay. So the reality is when we operate Office 365, we have to obey the laws in every country that we operate in. So if we get a legal request from a government, from anywhere that we operate Office 365 in, or that we have Office 365 customers in, we have to obey those laws. There are certain countries and certain laws that require things like, I think the correct legal term is blind subpoena, they say in the US, which is essentially a gag order. So we're giving you this request, and you're not allowed to tell anyone about it, and it's bound by this law. And in that case, I think that's what you're referring to.
And when the law is binding, Dutch law, for instance, has a very stringent privacy law.
Exactly, yeah.
When the data center is in Amsterdam, can the NSA force Microsoft to expose that data?
So, in the right of cases, absolutely. You know, any government can force us to expose data if we're operating within that country's laws. It's about following the laws of the countries that we operate in. So if there are laws on the books in those countries, and there are the same laws in the Netherlands, there are the same laws in the UK around certain cases like that, and we absolutely have to do it. The great thing about this is that we have great lawyers. You know, one of the things that we have with Microsoft, we see a lot of these capabilities, these sort of requests. We can filter these requests, we push back on these requests where we need to, these requests, and our first response is to notify the customer in those situations. You can determine which data set. If you're operating in Europe, you're operating in the Dublin and Amsterdam data centers. So you're not operating in the US data centers. Sorry? We don't offer that. This is part of how we meet our high availability, is by spreading the load over different geographical boundaries. You know, if a dam breaks in Amsterdam, we don't want to take that data center offline. We need to geographically distribute that information. That's part of the system. But our process is, it's your data. We're just a data processor. We have protections in laws, the EU model clauses, the EU safe harbor enforce a lot of those protections in the way that we operate the system. And we abide by those processes. Those processes get audited by our systems as well. So I'd advise you to check out the Trust Center, trust.office365.com. This goes into a lot of detail on all of the processes that we follow in the event of these sort of legal enforcement actions and those sorts of things as well. Yeah. Question?
Is the latest and greatest model suitable for every customer?
It may not be. You know, we think that, you know, when we look at some changes, there are breaking changes. There's things that we're just adding new functionality, and you can opt into using new functionality. And then there are also things that kind of change existing functionality as well. And so we need to be very thoughtful when we're making changes that kind of affect the user. But if we're adding new capabilities that light up and it's an option for the admin to turn on, you know, we kind of think about things that are off by default. An example of that is the Yammer integration today in Office 365. We turned that on about a month ago. And essentially that approach is, as an admin, you go in, you flick it on. I actually did it this morning. You flick it on, and it changes the news feed to SkyDrive. To Yammer and that environment. So that's kind of an approach we do. But there are customers where, you know, maybe they do want to sit out and sweat an asset for 10 years or 15 years at a time. That's great. That's not for Office 365. I don't think that model is sustainable, personally, long term. I think, you know, business is changing way too fast. But if that's where they're at right now, then they probably should consider. Typically, for this current upgrade, we've given people up to 12 months to make the transition. So they can delay that transition for up to 12 months in that approach. Yeah. So that gives you time to plan out, you know, if there are, you know, service comms that you want to do to your users to inform them of the changes and those sorts of things. You can delay those upgrades for up to 12 months as they come through as well. Yeah. Question? Sorry, could you repeat the question? With PSTN, like telecom solutions? Yes. So there's a couple of things that we're doing there. The first is on Skype integration. We're working really closely to make sure that Link to Skype is working now for voice calls, so you can call Skype numbers and Link numbers through that. There are a number of integration points. We have a system called Link to Phone that carriers and other providers can opt into, essentially integrating their systems direct into Office 365 to provide that, but it does require the telco to do that particular work. At the end of the day, we don't want to be a telco. You know, that's not our core business. We're Microsoft. We build IT systems, software systems, and those sorts of things. Interfacing with landlines, laying cables, and those sorts of things is not something that we want to get into. In those cases, you know, today we're relying on, you know, an approach where you're putting Link servers on premises to interact directly with your PSTN, and then just surfacing that into Office 365. But absolutely, yes. So we have telecommunication companies that integrate with Link Online directly and those sorts of things, but no plans to build out direct PSTN things. Yeah. Question? Yeah.
The multiple recycle-based SharePoint, it is great for someone deleting something.
Mm-hmm.
To me, the most common scenario is someone actually changing by mistake. Now, I know
you've
been versioning on the live system,
mm-hmm.
but you guys don't exactly help, because the SkyDrive Pro, for example, that's not versioned by default.
Yeah. Good feedback. So the question was, you know, it's great that we have recycle bins, but oftentimes we're not trying to prevent deletion of something. We're trying to roll back a change that's been made on a particular file. And we have version control in SharePoint Online. It's off by default in certain team sites. That's very good feedback. I'll take that on board. You know, it's something that it kind of crosses that level between what's the technology and what's the process of how you operate the system itself. You know, I remember before I joined Microsoft, you know, when I was working very closely with SharePoint with a lot of different customers, we would kind of remove all the standard team, all the standard templates. We'd make our own templates that had things like version control turned on, had different layouts and those sorts of things. And you can do that. And I agree that we probably don't provide enough prescriptive guidance in some of those areas as possible, but we also do want to make sure that the system's flexible for everyone. There are some groups that don't want that full versioning, that don't want that extra load, and some people just want, quite frankly, a place to drop documents, a file share that's web accessible. And so we try to meet all those needs. But I'd love to, yeah.
As long as if I can send you guys an email, you can restore the file for me. But so
yeah.
Does that happen today?
Yeah.
I contacted support a while back.
Mm-hmm.
I've had files running on here since as early as I could.
Yeah.
And I was told that, yeah, we can do a restore for you, but it's a full site collection restore.
Yeah.
So is that still
that's, the I believe so, yes, yeah. Okay, yeah. All right, well, thank you very much for your time, guys. I'm going to turn the microphone off and hang around the front. If you have any other questions, feel free to come up.